Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm happy now to welcome journalist and public interest lawyer John Atlas. He's president of the National Housing Institute, and he's author of the new book, Seeds of Change, the story of ACORN, America's most controversial anti-poverty community organizing group. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm glad to be here.
So ACORN is an organization that I've heard of for many, many years. Basically, my whole adult life, I've been aware of it. But it made the news during the last presidential election campaign in ways that were not so nice that we'll talk about in a moment. But what is this organization? How did it start?
Well, the organization evolved out of the 60s activism, or I should be more precise, out of the activism of the civil rights anti-war movement, and also the work by many activists and engaged citizens to help the farm workers in the 1960s. And this story really begins in 1970 with Wade Rathke, a young man who, 21 years old, who grew up in New Orleans during the 1950s and 60s, during a time when there was widespread opposition to school integration in the South. And he was a smart boy. He got into a very good school, Williams College. But because of his interest in fighting for social justice and against the war, he dropped out. He worked for the Welfare Rights Organization. But then he decided the anti-war movement and the Welfare Rights Organization really wasn't doing enough to help the working poor, ordinary Americans of all walks of life. So he decides to pursue this somewhat, you might think, quixotic dream of organizing poor people into a powerful group so that they could lift themselves out of poverty.
So what were some of the specific issues that they were addressing in this fight against poverty?
Well, at the beginning, the idea behind the group was not to look for specific issues, but for any issues around which the working poor were concerned. So when they go into a community, it could be that what the big issue might be stopping or putting up a stop sign in a dangerous intersection. Or it could be stopping predatory lending in that community. Or maybe they needed to take some vacant apartments that had been run down and the city owns them, and forcing the city to turn those apartments into decent, affordable apartment houses where people could live. Or it could be cleaning up a park. It's very common in any place ACORN started to organize. And by the way, they were in 38 states, over 1,000 neighborhoods, 100 cities at their peak. It would be very common to go into some low-income neighborhood and see a bunch of families and mothers and fathers and their children putting on garden gloves, black garbage bags and shovels, going into a garbage-strewn park, cleaning up the broken bottles, the glass, the newspapers, and turning an eyesore into a neighborhood asset. So they would do lots of that. And then some of the big issues that they later would take on included increasing the national minimum wage and ending predatory lending. Those would be some of the big issues, and also getting banks that were discriminating in low-income areas to provide loans so people could buy houses, make home repairs, or build new housing.
And we can talk about all of those things in turn. One of the things that this list that you've just made points out is that poor neighborhoods lack services in a city that other people, other neighborhoods do get. So one park is cleaned up by the city and another park isn't, just simply because of just bald-faced discrimination against the poor.
That's right. That's exactly right. So when they go into a community, they had this deep and abiding commitment to help the poor help themselves. Now that's a key thing that people often don't realize about Acorn. It really was not a organization that, for example, set up a food bank or a shelter. It was really about helping the poor help themselves. So they were not a what you call a typical anti-poverty group.
What were some of the methods that they used to do that? You described cleaning up a park. What were some of the others?
Well, generally speaking, this book is about, partly about, it's about a lot of things, but one of the things it's about the community organizing. So readers of Seeds of Change would learn what community organizing is. It's right, and that's a recent term that has gained some national resonance because we have the first president who's an ex-community organizer. So there was this interest in community organizing, but most people who don't do it don't have any idea what it is. You'll get a sense that what Acorn was about is this notion of community organizing. But part of what community organizing is all about is getting a good community organizer, or a community organizing Acorn style, always involves getting the people who will be affected to be a part of the solution, as I demonstrated in that cleaning up the park episode.
And what are some other ways they did it? So, in other words, around housing issues, how did the organizers go around organizing poor communities around both the lack of housing, substandard housing, and so on?
Well, so let me give you a sort of a little story about how it happens. The Acorn organizers will go into a low-income neighborhood. They'll look around and see what kind of problems exist. Then they'll start going door to door, actually knocking on doors, asking people what kind of problems they have. And then when a number of people say are interested in doing something in that community, they'll all have a meeting. They'll bring all the different people who are interested. They'll send out some flyers saying we're having a meeting, and then they'll sit around that meeting, and people will discuss what issues they ought to take on. And so it inevitably happens in almost any low-income community. You probably could go into any middle-class community now, certainly in certain urban areas of America, and the issue will be, we need some affordable housing. The prices of housing are just out of our reach. So that's a typical issue. So what they would do in a place where that became a serious issue is they would figure out, well, who can help us on this? Well, the city's not paying attention. The federal government doesn't really provide much help here either. But there is a law called the Community Reinvestment Act. And that law says to banks, whether it's big or small, that if you operate in a certain neighborhood, you have a responsibility to provide loans to that community. And I'm talking about mortgage loans, home improvement loans, and construction loans for builders, and particularly in low-income areas, nonprofit builders. So the Acorn Group would then meet with the bank, do some investigation, do the research. Inevitably, they would find that the bank discriminates against low-income people. They often would discriminate by putting literally a red line around the low-income area, especially Black and Hispanic areas. And then they would say, we don't lend in that area. Well, once Acorn had the goods on a bank, then they would say, well, if you don't do something about this, we are going to complain to the federal regulatory agency, and we're also going to make sure the whole community and as many people as we can know as we can contact, know that you are discriminating and you're a bad bank, and we'll have demonstrations and pickets in front of your bank. Well, inevitably, those two factors come together, the pressure on the federal government, pressure from the federal government, and this public demonstrations led banks to say, you know what, let's negotiate with this group, maybe we can reach some kind of agreement. And the agreement often would be to provide mortgage loans at less than market rates, so they would get a break on the interest rates on their mortgage or home improvement loan. And this made the purchase of housing more affordable. This, by the way, resulted in literally thousands of people throughout the country becoming homeowners. And I would add, because a lot of people, Acorn has been accused of using the CRA to, and as a result of that, causing the subprime crisis. I don't know if you've ever heard that attack. It's in the book, but it's preposterous.
Yeah.
Totally ridiculous. And because Acorn loans turned out to be very solid and they never defaulted.
We're talking to John Atlas about his book, Seeds of Change. It does, what you're saying really illustrates what I think is a very important point, which is once a law is passed, it still doesn't get enforced by governmental structures. You actually have to have community groups putting pressure to get laws that are already on the books enforced.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, sometimes when some people have difficulty understanding what you said, it reminds me of a maxim. You know this maxim, it's an old saying that if you give a hungry person a fish, he or she will eat that day. But if you teach them how to fish, they eat every night.
Right, right.
You ever heard that one?
Many times.
Right. But the Acorn story has a new twist to that. What if the river where you fish is polluted and the fish are dying? Then what? Well, the hungry person who learned how to fish will need to organize, join a community group that can mobilize public opinion, demonstrate against the corporate polluters, sue them, and then, as you suggest, if there's a law on the books, they have to put pressure on the government officials to put pressure on the polluters to clean up that water. So the lesson is that if you want to help the poor, you got to not only teach them how to fish, you got to teach them how to fight.
And that's what Acorn did. One of the methods that they used, which at the time seemed, was certainly unorthodox in community organizing, was to organize around electoral politics, which before that had been seen really as a kind of impenetrable machine. How did they do that?
Well, first they had a philosophy, particularly the organizer, Wade Rathke, and that was, if you want to do more than provide Band-Aids for the poor, the organization needed power, and power was proven on election day. So he used to say, victories are won in the streets, but they ratified at the polls. And, of course, what I mean by in the streets are the example that I gave you about cleaning up the parks or forcing banks to make affordable loans. So they thought engaging in elections was absolutely critical, and I think that they proved to be right, because my book suggests that Acorn was the most effective anti-poverty organization in America for four decades. So why did they do it and hardly anybody else did it? Well, one, I think it was because people feared it would hurt their tax-exempt status. A lot of anti-poverty groups in America are tax-exempt, and therefore they can't get involved in partisan politics. That means that they're fighting powerful interests with one hand tied behind their back. Second, I think a lot of groups don't even have the power to mobilize members, so they wouldn't be able to make a difference during election time. And then the third reason, I think, is that a lot of community organizing groups were steeped in the philosophy of Saul Alinsky. And he believed that it was best to stay away from partisan politics because it risked dividing the group. Acorn did the opposite and won major victories, as we have suggested.
What was Acorn's relationship like with the Democratic Party?
Well, I would call it an inside-outside strategy, meaning that most of the time they operated outside any party, and they never saw themselves as part of any party. They, in fact, would endorse or fight for any politician, Republican or Democrat or Independent, that agreed with their issues. Now, it turns out that at one point, there would be what we would call something of, I think, an anachronism now. I would call it a moderate Republican. I don't know if they exist anymore. But Acorn, or even liberal Republicans, it wouldn't be unusual for Acorn to throw their support behind that person. It was basically based on the issues. So it turns out that although they have no love for the Democratic Party, turns out that the Democratic Party, more than any other, more than the Republicans certainly, fought for the issues that Acorn cared about, such as increasing the minimum wage, more affordable housing, enforcement of the Community Reinvestment Act, and just as you suggest, having more fair distribution of city services. But I always have to point out that when it comes to Democrats, on a local level, they were opposed to Democrats far more often than they were fighting Republicans.
Can you say more about that?
Well, you take any community. For example, I have a chapter in my book on the fight for the minimum wage and the living wage in Chicago. Well, the opposition wasn't the Republican Party. It was Mayor Richard Daley who was the opposition. He's a Democrat, a very powerful Democrat. So you can see that any attempt to, label Acorn as a arm of the Democratic Party is ludicrous.
You would think that the Democratic Party, when this high-energy mobilizing of voters and of citizens kind of group would be, just starts to exist and starts to gain power and traction, you would think that the Democratic Party would embrace them because at least the stated goals are very similar, which is lifting people out of poverty and some semblance of economic and social justice, but they really didn't.
Yeah, let's face it. A lot of people go into politics, Democrat or Republican, not for any high-minded purpose, but to either because they're ego-driven or they think it's a way to make a lot of money. I mean, I'm sorry to say that, but isn't it true?
I guess. I mean, it depends what you're looking at. I mean, in local politics, that isn't necessarily the case at all. Certainly not in a place where we live.
Well, you're in Santa Fe, right?
Yeah.
New Mexico. Well, New Mexico is a little bit different. I think the politics in New Mexico are different than, for example, New York City or Chicago or Boston or a lot of these cities, which they're dominated by one party.
Right, and they're just so huge. Let's talk about the voter registration drives that Acorn did. That was a huge part of their work, and again, they got into some trouble fairly recently about it, but it was a long-term successful part of Acorn's work.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up the voter registration because most people do want to know about that story, but I think it's really important to talk about the voter registration to folks in New Mexico because in my book, what I tried to do in each chapter is I tried to focus on some organizers, some members of Acorn, and take the reader to different parts of the country where there's these dramatic confrontations between Acorn and the powers that be whether they are corporations or politicians, take place. And one of the most fascinating stories is the voter registration struggle, I really call it a struggle, between Acorn and the Republican Party. To understand the Acorn voter registration controversy, you must understand that Republicans have tried to suppress voting of blacks and minorities for decades. But I like to take that my story begins with the close election in 2000 that would put Acorn in the crosshairs of the Republican Party. And at that time, you'll recall, Gore won the election in 2000, you remember, and the Supreme Court, in effect, appointed Bush to be the president. But the point was is that Karl Rove, the chief political operator for the Republican Party, saw what happened, and he was correct in seeing that this was the United States is a very evenly divided electorate. Neither the Democrats nor the Republicans dominate. It's very, very close. So for the Republicans to stay in party in power, Rove had to do two things. He had to increase the voter turnout of his base and get money from the drug companies, the oil companies, and Wall Street. And then on the other hand, he had to suppress the voter turnout of poor minorities and the young. And he understood just a slight increase in voter turnout of the poor minorities and young can throw national elections to the Democratic parties, maybe forever, if the Democrats could win those key swing states. Now, two of the key swing states that I focus on are Florida and New Mexico. And in 2000, Bush lost that election in 2000 by just 360 votes. So they knew that if they were going to win New Mexico back, the Republicans, I should say, they were going to have to suppress voters of minority and Hispanic in particular.
So you're saying that Bush lost in the state of New Mexico by 300 and some votes.
Right, right, yeah. In 2000. Okay, so now it's 4 years later. The election's heating up, and Acorn recognizes the same thing that Rove recognizes. This is an evenly divided electorate, and just a small increase in voter turnout can throw the election away from the party of big oil, the drug companies, and Wall Street, and turn it, potentially at least, to an agenda that would care about increasing workers' wages, creating more jobs, and helping a majority of Americans rather than a small minority. So they decided to start a massive voter registration campaign in 2004. It would ultimately result in nearly a million people being registered to vote over the next few years. But here's what happened. What Acorn didn't know was that Rove had decided he was going to gear up for a massive a crackdown on what they would call voter registration fraud in battleground states like New Mexico and Florida. And it would be an all-out assault, trumped-up lawsuits, media events, smear campaigns, and even the mobilization of United States attorneys who work for the Justice Department, the United States Justice Department, to seek out and find and investigate any group that was making a big dent on voter registration. So now let's go back into New Mexico. What's happening right before the election in 2004 in New Mexico? Keep in mind that only 360 votes led to the Gore victory. Well, by that summer of 2004, Acorn had registered in
in Albuquerque and the surrounding area, 35,000 voters, and they weren't Republicans. So what happened? Well, the U.S. attorney there, a fellow named David C. Iglesias, New Mexico U.S. attorney. Do you remember that incident?
Yeah, we interviewed him on this program about that very incident.
Okay, so you know what happened. And all the documents, you know, he testified and has written a whole book about how he was in effect ordered to investigate Acorn in particular. And he did an investigation, a very thorough one. And he came to the conclusion that it was a boogeyman. There was no voter registration fraud. I mean, there were some voter registration cards that had Social Security card numbers missing or signatures missing, minor problems. But the truth was that nobody was intending to do voter registration. No organization was intending to do voter registration fraud. These were just ordinary mistakes that then the right wing, the Republican media campaign and smear campaign used to generate a lot of press, a lot of activity, a lot of lawsuits against Acorn to defame them, to make them look bad. It turned out there was nothing to it. Well, but that exact scenario that took place in New Mexico in 2004 turned out to be the precursor of a similar campaign in 2008, but that campaign would result in victory for the Republican Party because they would end up using that as a way of smearing and ultimately destroying Acorn.
We're talking to John Atlas, author of the book Seeds of Change, The Story of Acorn, America's Most Controversial Anti-Poverty Community Organizing Group. Two young conservative activists took it upon themselves to do a sting operation on Acorn. The woman posed as a prostitute. Tell us that whole story.
Okay, that's the other big story that really hurt Acorn. It's very important that I link both of these stories to the role of the mainstream press and the right-wing press, because they play very, very important roles here. Anyway, what happened with those videotapes? Well, we all know what happened. Some pimp and prostitute, a guy who looked like a pimp and a prostitute, walked into Acorn offices, and they gave them advice on how to set up a brothel. The only problem with that scenario is that the tapes were misleading, edited, and deceptive in two critical ways. The first that was that in almost all the offices except one or two that the two people visited, the activists visited with their hidden camera, the Acorn staff turned them away, asked them to leave, and then reported them to the police. And in one case, actually took the fake prostitute to a counseling service for young women threatened by their pimp. You know, that's what they said that they were doing. That was the story that the prostitute and the pimp told Acorn staff to entrap them into saying something stupid. So you can see that Acorn acted responsibly in most of the offices. The second most damaging video was the shots of James O'Keefe, and he was the man with the video camera, that appeared to show him in Acorn offices looking like the stereotype of a 1970s Superfly pimp with his, you know, huge sunglasses and white cape and cane, getting advice from the Acorn staff. Well, it turned out that O'Keefe, when he entered those offices, was in fact wearing a dress shirt and slacks, identified himself as a prostitute's boyfriend or a student, not a pimp, and he was there to protect the prostitute against this dangerous pimp. How come we always remember that Superfly outfit? They were edited in afterwards. And I think purposely so, to make Acorn's staff, which is mostly poor and African, a lot of them are poor, certainly African American, to look like buffoons. And I think there was some racism there. So you can see that, this was a sting operation of the most vile sort.
There was no attempt by these right-wing activists to get at any truth. They just wanted to bring Acorn down.
Which they succeeded in doing, and, I mean, the one point they had is they did manage, after trying very hard, to get a couple of Acorn employees to say really stupid, ridiculous things that they shouldn't have said. But
yes, no, there's no question that in three of the offices, the staff said stupid things. But of course, you always have to put everything in perspective. There was nothing done. They didn't really execute any documents. They didn't provide tax information. They didn't do any tax returns. They didn't fill out any mortgage applications. Because that would have all been caught by the supervisors. So nothing bad would have happened, but it certainly made Acorn look dubious. But this is the key. All of that would have gone for naught, despite the fact that the Fox News and the Wall Street Journal editorial page and the rest of the right-wing echo chamber tried to say what the right-wing activists were deceptively saying was true. But this is what happened, and this is the saddest part of the story, and in some ways, the most excruciating and disgraceful part, and that is the role of the mainstream media. When the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN repeated these false stories as fact, then Acorn's supporters, some of its members, even some of its staff, but certainly its foundation supporters and the members of the Democratic Party became very suspicious of Acorn. They thought, maybe we don't really know this organization like we thought we did, and they all ran for the hills. Wouldn't have happened without that.
What's fascinating to me is that Acorn was totally exonerated. Everybody knows about the prostitute tapes. Nobody knows about the exoneration. And even the media with a lot of money and resources didn't investigate the tapes in the first place, and then didn't really print any kind of, I don't know if you want to call it a retraction, or just updated information that they were exonerated.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of outrageous. It's disheartening. But it does point out the important role that the alternative media play in this country. But my criticism of the alternative media, or maybe it's not a criticism, it's unfair, is that somehow the right-wing echo chamber in the talk shows and among the blogosphere have been able to force the mainstream media to report they've cowed the mainstream media into going along with vicious and crazy stories like this, perpetrated by people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and this guy Breitbart, to report them as a lot of press. They've really been intimidated, literally intimidated, by the right wing, don't you think?
Well, it certainly would seem that way, although it is a little hard to understand why this goes on and to what extent it's pressure from right-wing media and to what extent it is some kind of relationship with the corporate entities that are supporting their advertising.
Well, it's probably interactive. It has something to do with both, I think. But I will tell you this. My experience has been, as I delved into the Acorn story trying to figure this out, is that the conservatives and the right-wing do not hesitate to call up reporters, call up editors, call up owners of the newspapers, yelling and screaming and saying, you're distorting the news, you're not reporting everything, you're missing this story, you failed to, they still to this day think the mainstream media missed the story on Acorn, the criminal enterprise.
So ultimately you have this powerful community organizing group helping people very successfully here and there, obviously not across the board because we still have horrible poverty and inequality in the United States, but nevertheless, helping people to lift themselves out of poverty, having successful voter registration drives, dealing with some of the worst subprime mortgage stuff, and so on and so on, brought down by a combination of this sting operation by these two young people and basically right-wing media pressure. What happened? What happened to this group? Did they completely disband?
Well, you just said the bad news. And by the way, it really, the most important players in bringing it down were the fact that the Republican Party leadership decided to go after Acorn. And they decided to go after Acorn in the 2008 with, using all their arsenal and every weapon in their arsenal, because they had a strategy to defame Acorn and then pin Acorn to the chest of Obama, and thereby guilt by association. So they were, and therefore, you know, this trying to destroy his reputation in the eyes of the public. I think it didn't work, but it might have worked had it been a closer election. I mean, people just voted against Bush, and they would have they wanted anybody. So that's one thing I document in my book and show how that happened.
When you say Bush, you mean McCain.
I'm sorry. Yes, thank you. I mean McCain, who went on TV in the third debate and looked Obama in the eye, and McCain said to Obama, you are very closely associated with this group Acorn that is destroying the fabric of American democracy. So, it's actually flabbergasting that that this organization, then you called them a powerful organization, but they were only Acorn was only powerful, relatively speaking. That is, they were powerful compared to the rest of the anti-poverty groups, which have almost no power. So it's not that Acorn was so powerful, it was that they were just much more significant and more relevant than most of the other groups. Now, the good news, as you were suggesting, is that the leaders, the organizers, the members, and the allies of Acorn are reorganizing in 17 or 18 states. And I believe New Mexico is one of them. But they're independent of Acorn. Acorn has been dissolved. And new organizations, independent of each other, but who believe deeply in the unfairness of American society. They believe deeply in strengthening our democracy, believe in public policies that don't just help the rich and the powerful, but can be used to help ordinary people of all walks of life, are reorganizing using Acorn's methods and techniques. And I think that I predicted in my book, in my epilogue, which was way before any of this was actually happening, that it would happen. And I still believe not only will it happen, but I think that they will succeed.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out, first of all, that the majority of the membership of Acorn was poor African-American and Latino membership, not totally, but they played a huge role in Acorn's work and in its membership, and how fundamentally undemocratic our country is and how much hostility arises every time people try to organize for their most basic rights and to become part of the society, particularly brown and black people.
Yes, yes. I think that's right. I would say that I argue that there are two interesting things that need to be understood. One is, if Acorn was so good, how come they didn't do more? And I go into some length explaining that during the last four decades, in fact, we have been living in a conservative era. And so, and Acorn's had few allies committed to bread and butter economic issues, class issues. Even though Acorn was 80% by the time it went under, African American and Hispanic, the issues that they mostly focused around, not totally, but mostly, were issues like increasing workers' wages and income through living wage movements, increasing opportunities for home ownership so that it'd be affordable, and other kinds of bread and butter issues, and not focused on racial issues alone. There are very few organizations that during the last 4 decades, maybe except the labor unions that I know of, that focused most of their energy on those kind of issues. Not that the other issues are not important, they are. But ACORN was alone, almost alone in promoting what I would call economic populist issues.
How did you decide to write this book? You did it over a period of quite a number of years.
Yeah, well, I actually started in 2004 because, like a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, I'm just like them and just like you, probably. I have always been concerned about making our communities better, fighting for more social justice, fighting around economic issues, issues of race, poverty. And I was a public interest lawyer, as you said earlier. And I know how difficult it is to make even a small difference, you know, right? Very hard. You got to work very, very hard just to make a small difference. Get that stop sign up at a dangerous intersection. But I had heard and read that ACORN was making big differences. I wanted to find out if it was true. If it was true, how did they do it? And then tell the public about it. If it wasn't true, I would tell a different story.
And so they let you into their meetings and into their files, and you read virtually everything that had ever come out of them. I mean, it was a huge immersion in decades of their work.
Yes, I was everything, every day, all day, for almost 4 years. I for some of the main characters in the story, so that my readers would get a sense of who they are, what made them tick, what part of the country they worked in, I would follow them around to their meetings. And then if there was a break, we would have coffee, and then they would go on and do some more, take a trip. I'd get in the train with them. And I really wanted to understand who they were, what motivated them, why they were successful. I met the leadership at a time when they decided that it would be a good idea for people to know the story. I think that they were suspicious. They wanted to do it, but there were some difficulties. I sometimes had, not often, but a few times. Saying, look, I need to have full access to all the information because I want this. It has to be an honest story. And there's lots of things in there that you can imagine they don't like that I told about.
Tell us about the two leaders of ACORN. You mentioned Wade Rathke at the beginning and then Bertha Lewis. Who was each one and how did they get to be an organizer and a leader?
I gave some idea earlier on about Wade Rathke. You know, he came like a lot of the old-timers, we could say, the people who got involved in the 70s. They were motivated mostly by the civil rights movement and the United Farm Workers movement. It's uncanny that everybody I talked to would point, who was an organizer from ACORN back in the 70s and 80s, would point to those two events as being very important in their lives. And Wade Rathke was one of them. When there was a scandal in ACORN in 2000 involving Wade Rathke's brother, who embezzled almost $1 million, and this would later, when it came out public, this would later lead to a change in leadership. And the leader that the board chose was a woman named Bertha Lewis, an African-American from New York City. But she was born in the segregated South in a migrant workers' camp in Florida. Her mother was 16 years old at the time she had Bertha. Bertha's mother was tenacious. Bertha had close aunts and uncles, and they nurtured her. For example, when they moved to Philadelphia up north, Bertha was educated in a Mennonite preschool. She got a great education. She grew up to be a very smart woman, very well read. Went to college, graduated from college, and became a Broadway, off-Broadway producer. And like so many people who get involved in Acorn, something happened to her personally. She was looking for an affordable, decent place to live. Very, very hard to find in the 80s because of widespread abandonment of apartments. And she found an apartment in the Bronx. It was run down, but it was something she could afford for her and her son. And then after they moved in, along with the rest of the tenants, the owners abandoned the building. And so there was nobody to pay rent to. But she then led an organizing effort to mobilize all the tenants there. And I go into, in the book, I go into some detail about the drama behind her efforts to become educated as a militant, fearless activist, because when they took this building over, the owner who abandoned it decided he wanted it back, and he called out the police, and there was lawsuits, and it was almost a massive violence. But in any case, Bertha won, and somebody who knew about that incident said, you know, you ought to check into this group Acorn. I bet you they could use you. And she did, and then she rose to be the executive director of New York Acorn, and then eventually the head of National Acorn.
You know, if this attack, this set of orchestrated attacks on Acorn had not happened, your book would have played a different role than it is now. Now it's a kind of historical document about this group rather than an encouragement for people to get involved.
Well, I would argue that the book... Well, first, I think what it turned out to be is a very powerful narrative, emblematic of America in the 21st century, where an organization that was as American as apple pie, that was doing everything that we would expect some group to do in America, is suddenly... And certainly has to be considered a bizarre, if not disgraceful, event, gets destroyed. In a story to me, as I was writing it, I thought I couldn't make this up. This was stranger than fiction. So for the reader, it turns out to be quite a dramatic story. It turns into a tragedy because Acorn was destroyed. However, I think essentially this is a book of hope. This is a book of success. This is a book that tells people what one group of people did and will do again to actually make not just a small difference, but a big difference. And so I think that readers can learn how to improve their own community by using some of the tactics and strategies of Acorn. Certainly the broader left, people with broader vision and capacity within the union movement, the environmental movement, the women's movement, the gay rights movement, I think all these progressive groups, I need to understand how, from the Acorn story, how important it is that we build a larger, more powerful progressive movement in which we all act together, and that one organization such as Acorn, we should never let this happen again. But we'll only be able to do that if we're a lot more powerful, a lot more united, a lot more coherent in our messaging and strategies.
John Atlas is a journalist, public interest lawyer, president of the National Housing Institute, and author of the new book, Seeds of Change, the story of Acorn, America's most controversial anti-poverty community organizing group. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I really appreciate talking to you. It's been a great interview.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you, too. An important and great read for me, and I hope for our readers. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, hasta mañana. Ciao.